Please ask your questions if you would like.
Yes. When you talked about the quality of atamma,
atamayata,
the quality of not no knower and no known, just knowing and being, if that's correct, is it the same quality as nibbana? Is it the same quality as nibbana?
Well, it's when that quality of awareness is established, then the result of that is nibbana. So nibbana is like the when the mind is free of clinging. That's the see the effect of that. So they're connected.
Probably not in relation, but in,
if you can,
in the attempt to recognize the here and now, how close do we look at the here and now? For instance, in terms of the presence, is it the present or the presence, the feeling of being in the presence, of sensation slowing, of sound slowing, or but when at least I try to look more at the different vibrations that happen, it becomes like concentration is not comfortable. So this here and now, how is it?
Can we keep this microphone on? So it's the if you try too hard, then even if there's not the thought, I must try hard, then that very kind of intensity can be stressful. So that when this quality of awareness is really perfected, there's a relaxed attitude, a relaxed quality to it. It's not kind of me trying to do something. So it's very bright, very energetic, but it's not stressful. So but as I've been saying quite a few times during this week, you have to look at the results of the way that the mind is working. The vimamsa, okay, what's the effect of this? So you can see sometimes, yes, the mind is very bright or very clear, very focused, but it's not peaceful. Or it's very peaceful and calm, but it's kind of half asleep. So that looking at what is the result, that vimamsa, that's how you measure, okay, left a bit, right a bit, okay, hold steady. And so that's the only reliable kind of measure. Yeah, as I've said a few times, we can be sort of following a method or following some instruction, I'm trying to do the right thing. And we can get so busy trying to do the right thing that we don't notice what the effect of that is. Right? So that that vimamsa, that looking at the results, say, well, how is this? What's the felt sense of this? What is it? How is it? That's the most reliable guide. It's like, okay, I wanted to get to Puchai Sai. Am I here yet? Rather than sort of going by, well, I should be because we've been traveling far enough. Or is that, well, what do the signs say? The indicators here and now. Okay, well, this is Puchai Sai. Okay, I can relax because I'm here. This is where I wanted to get to. So if you're already here, you don't have to worry about getting here. Because you're here already, if that makes sense. So oftentimes what can happen is that the mind can be sort of can be very focused on the present and can have let go of things, but the mind is so, well, I should be doing something, I should be getting somewhere, that this can't be it. And so it's rather like being at Pu Chai Sai looking for Pu Chai Sai. It's like, you're here already, chill, you know, relax. And so I feel that expression of Lumpur Cha's about Nibbana, is that this is the reality of non-grasping is Nibbana. That's not to cheapen it. I mean, so just as soon as I relax, that's Nibbana. That's kind of pretty easy. But it's you know, every kind of grasping as well. So, but it's... if you're always looking for some sort of special event somewhere else, or this is, you know, liberation, or Nibbana is some kind of big, you know, rainbows in the sky, and or Devadas come along and say, congratulations, well done, yeah. Then the peace that is present when the mind stops grasping, you don't notice it because you're so busy looking for something else. In Lumpur Sumedho's teachings, he often emphasizes in the third noble truth, you know, for each of the four noble truths, there's a way that the Buddha describes to work with them. So the first noble truth, dukkha, needs to be understood, needs to be apprehended, parinyayanti. The cause of dukkha, tanha, needs to be let go of, pahatabanti. The ending of dukkha, dukkha nirodha, needs to be realized, sachikata banti. So you need to notice when the suffering has stopped. Because you can be so busy, go, let go, let go, let go, let go. It's like, you know, you've let go. There's nothing to let go of. Well, I should let go, I should let go. But you already did. And so that when that letting go has happened, and the dukkha has stopped, then to notice, oh, right now there is no dukkha. So in Lumpur Sumedho's teachings, over and over again, he says, you have to notice, it's the most difficult one, because peace is boring. Peace is not interesting. Tanha is interesting. Suffering is interesting. Peace is not interesting. Like he would say, you never get a newspaper saying, Ajahn Sumedho breathed in and breathed out. It would not sell many newspapers. Ajahn Sumedho is filled with desire. Ooh, you want to read about that? Yeah. So it takes more effort to notice peace. So he would give instruction about noticing space, noticing peacefulness, the keeping the attention on that quality of peace, of space, of silence, of noticing that, because the attention won't stay there, it wants to go to the next interesting thing. But if we want to realize Nibbana, you need to train the mind to notice peace and space, and stillness, and to stay with that. And then that peace that initially was boring is boring to the atta, but to the jitta it's home. So that if that peacefulness is recognized, and then really relaxed into, then there's a quality of sambun, of completeness, of contentment as well. That peace is not boring then. That peace is very, very satisfying. Okay. There's a question behind, if you can wait for the microphone behind you. Oh.
Grab. I was going to ask about Nibbana as well. Because in the interview session on Tuesday,
you can speak up.
I was going to ask about Nibbana as well, but Rajan already gave the thoughts and wisdoms about it. But then I want to talk about your idea about the book called Nibbana for Everyone, because you said the true meaning of Nibbana is coolness, is non-grasping. And I also thought about the creativity in monastic life that was discussed yesterday. I think this is the creativity that you came up with, because in the world that I came from, in advertising industry, creativity is all about idea. And you came up with the idea for the book, said Nibbana is for everyone. Because in most of the Buddhist mind, Nibbana is the ultimate goal or destination. A lot of people, except a few ones that you said that they want to see their dogs in their next life or their grandchildren. But to me, I ask Prajan that is also a very unreachable goal for attain or realize Nibbana. Then your idea is Nibbana for everyone as a book. So you already answered the lady about Nibbana, which is very, very clear and thoughtful. But I know there is a lot to learn about it, and I'm waiting for reading your book.
Well, it's Ajahn Buddhadasa's book, I think it's called The Nibbana for Everyone. I think the book already exists, if I remember correctly. Yes? So you can go to BIA and get a copy. It's probably online as well. So, I think also in terms of creativity, it's like the most pure kind of creativity comes from that empty space. It's not just about thinking. It kind of maybe it takes shape as thinking, but it comes from that that kind of awake, empty quality, and so that. You know, in Japanese art, in the Zen tradition, they have a lot of the way they speak about their creative process is to empty the mind completely, and then when the moment comes, then you get your brush, and then there's this perfect calligraphy, you know, appears, or a poem arises, but it's come from that awake, empty quality, because a when we speak about Nibbana, it's coolness, but it's perfectly peaceful, but it's also a super high energy state. So virya is one of the factors of enlightenment. Yeah. Virya, Ajahn Kongrit was reciting those the other day. He got all seven of them. The mindfulness is the first one. Then Dhammavijaya, Virya, Piti. So those are the energizing aspects of the enlightened mind. You have Piti, which is rapture or bliss. You have Dhammavijaya, investigation, and kind of that quality of curiosity, the reflective wisdom. Virya, energy. So those are all the kind of rousing aspects, the kind of brightness of mind. The enlightened mind is very, very bright, energized, and curious. It's interested. There's Dhamma Vijaya. It looks into how things work. And then the last three, Pasati, Samadhi, Upeka, they're the kind of calming ones. So Pasati is calmness or coolness, that kind of settled quality. Samadhi is concentration, Upeka, even-mindedness. But the awake mind, the enlightened mind, has all those qualities. So it's perfectly peaceful, but it's totally energized as well. So that when we speak about creativity, it's like that energy of that awake mind kind of being given a shape, given a direction. Kongrit, anything to say about?
บางทีพวกเราก็ได้ยินได้ฟังแล้วความพยายามพวกเราก็เยอะเสร็จเหมือนท่านพระอาจารย์ยกตัวอย่างว่าอยากจะมาภูชัยใสถ้ามาถึงภูชัยใสแล้วเราก็ไม่ต้องมีความว่าอยากจะมาบางทีปัญหาของพวกเราก็คือเรามาถึงภูชัยใสแล้วแต่ยังไม่แน่ใจว่าถึงหรือยังเราก็เดินไปเดินมาเพื่อจะให้แน่ใจว่าถึงภูชัยใสหรือยังก็เลยต้องพยายามวิธีพยายามอย่างหนึ่งก็คือทำบ่อยๆเข้าออกบ่อยๆแล้วก็เริ่มรู้ว่าอ๋อนี่จริงๆนี่เรามาถึงที่นี่แล้วภูชัยใสแต่พอดีไม่เห็นป้ายพอไม่มีป้ายความไม่แน่ใจก็เกิดขึ้นแล้วพูดถึงเรื่องสมาธิเรื่องนิพพานนิพพาน คนส่วนใหญ่ทั่วไปก็เข้าใจว่าตัวเองอยากไปนิพพานแต่พอถึงจุดบางจุดเรามีความรู้สึกกลัวกลัวเพราะว่ามันไม่มีอะไรคำว่าไม่มีอะไรนี่คนจะกลัวมากโดยเฉพาะกลัวว่าจะไม่มีเราอยู่หรือบางคนก็กลัวไม่มีลูกไม่มีหลานไอเดียก็คือดีอยู่ว่านิพพานนะอยากไปแต่ว่าพอได้ยินคุณภาพของพระนิพพานก็ไม่ค่อยอยากจะไปธรรมะเคยได้ยินท่านพระอาจารย์เล่าให้ฟังว่าภิกขุโบดิท่านเป็นคนเชื้อสายยิวอยู่ที่นิวยอร์กแล้วก็บวชเป็นพระจริงๆคนยิวนี่ไม่ชอบให้ลูกชายไปบวชเป็นพระคนทั่วไปก็ไม่ชอบให้ลูกชายไปบวชเป็นพระภิกษุโบดิไปเยี่ยมบ้านเสร็จนะคุณพ่อก็โกรธมากไม่รู้จะว่ายังไงท่านก็บอกว่า look at you are nothing คือมันที่สุดแล้วเพราะว่าคุณพ่อก็อยากให้เป็นนายธนาคารเป็นอะไรเหมือนคนไทยอยากให้ลูกเป็นนั่นแหละแต่ว่าพอเห็นลูกกลับไปเป็นพระแล้วก็กลับบ้านไปอย่างเงี้ยพ่อบอกว่า you are nothingพระภิกขุโพธิท่านก็บอกว่าบอกพ่อว่าเนี่ยที่พ่อพูดมาเนี่ยใน tradition ของท่านเนี่ยมันสูงมากถ้าเป็น nothing เนี่ยโอเคมันสุดยอดนะ
dad with the people I hang out with that's quite a compliment
แล้วอีกอันหนึ่งที่คนไทยเรากลัวมากๆก็คือว่าไม่กลัวไม่ได้ผุดไม่ได้เกิดใช่ไหมเคยได้ยินไหมเวลาใครบอกว่าขออย่าให้ผุดอย่าให้ได้เกิดพวกเราจะโกรธมากอาตมาก็ให้เปลี่ยนความคิดว่าเกิดมีใครมาด่าเราว่าขออย่าให้ได้ผุดอย่าให้ได้เกิดเราให้รีบสาธุนั่นเราไปพระนิพพานแล้วไม่ได้เกิดอีกแล้ว
so please
thank you นมัสการท่านอาจารย์ค่ะIn the last few sittings, I apply one of your advice, one of your teaching about begin with setting up straight spine, and then let everything around the spine soften. In a sitting, first of all, it was the spine, and then it's become the breath, the center of the breath.And I think after that it becomes some kind of I would call it citta. So it works really well to keep coming back to that and allowing the surrounding to soften and relax around that. So what I'd like to hear the request from you, Ajahn, is to talk a little bit about these things with the center.With the core center in relation to pure awareness, because that's what I always talk about in my work with the people I work with, training courses and classes. So I know you talk a lot about pure awareness already, and I would definitely review that. But I'd like to hear your advice or your word on this. So pure awareness in relation to core center.And I say I will say citta with all the things surrounding that.
So when you say the core center, I mean how? Because that that aware quality is what's at the center. Really, that's where everything is known. So I mean, also words like core and center, they're.To do with space, but in a way the mind doesn't exist in space. That we talk about here and there, but that space only really applies to rupakanda, and the mind you can't really say it's anywhere. Awareness doesn't quite apply, but we can say that it's the experience is known here in this awareness in this mind.I think that it's one of the qualities of insight, And this was something that I found a few years ago, that we can, in a sense, create that feeling of everything is happening here in this spot. But even that is a kind of attachment. I remember years ago when we had a winter retreat at Wattapaikiri, and I was there in California, and it was a very small community, and the winter was quite cold, so it was very easy to not many visitors. So it was, the situation was very quiet, very peaceful, very contained. And so after 2 or 3 weeks of the retreat time, my mind was very, very, very quiet, and I could in the meditation could watch the anicca dukkha anatta of experience very clearly, and everything was very calm, peaceful. And I got this feeling of, well, yeah, there's some kind of stickiness, there's some kind of stressing here now. But it's obvious, everything is anicca, it's all dukkha, it's all anatta, that's totally clear. So what's this kind of tension? And then there was this realization, oh, it's happening here. The mind is creating here-ness, it's sort of attaching to a physical place. And then I came across this comment of Lungta Mahabua when he's described his insight of his own, in his own practice, where the way it was phrased in English was as soon as there is a center to the knower, that is the essence of birth in some level of being. So even that feeling of a center or a spot where things are happening, that needs to be let go of. So since that time, I talk about awareness as being not just not self and timeless, free of time and identity, but also free of location. So it's not an easy thing to describe in English, but say like non-locality or unlocatedness, which is a very long word. But it's that, in a way, it's that realization that the mind is not anywhere. Awareness doesn't apply in the world of mind. You can't say, yeah, this mind stops here and that mind stops there. You know, there's a gap between there isn't a stopping or a starting, there isn't a border. That place doesn't really apply in the world of the nama khandas. So Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. Place doesn't really apply. So that might sound a bit too philosophical or a bit too kind of hard to grasp, but I feel it's a very useful, helpful insight, because that the mind can still hold on to this is my life, my mind, my body, I experience it here, but even that quality of here-ness needs to be let go of. It's a subtle quality of insight, but when that was seen during that retreat time, I spent the rest of the 3 months kind of looking at that. Oh. And so how strong that is, that because the senses, you know, the eyes are on the head and the ears are on the head and the body has got a location in space, then it makes that kind of clue that this is the center. But I took that phrase of Lungta Mahabua, that as soon as there is a center of the knower, so I'd use a kind of investigation. I say, does this knowing have a center? Or where is the mind? Or where is the knowing? And just by asking that question, it opens up the space, as it were. Then the trick is to leave the space open, rather than to for the mind to grasp again. So you can, but I find that kind of reflective thought, investigation, the kind of pijarana, or Dhamma Vijaya, using a question like that, like where is here? And it's not like, yeah, here is Puchai Sai, or you know, here is Wattapaikiri, but where just to ask a question reveals the presumption that the mind is making, the attitude the mind is holding, And when the mind says, well, where is this? Oh, like, or a question like, you know, who am I? Then if you remember when in that session in India, you know, talking about that question, who am I? When that question is brought into the empty mind, the word who obviously doesn't apply. It's like, it's not a who, it's more of a what. And so that you can use those kind of questions to help break up the habits of perception and the attitudes that limit that boundless, immeasurable, profound quality of that awareness.
Can I just ask just one more simple question?
I was going to ask Ajahn Chah if he has any comments to make. Maybe, yeah? Okay, go ahead.
So when, yes, I did exactly what you just said. So I jump into the center, it was quite an interesting visual. And yes, it opened up into space everywhere. And suddenly what happened was the natural world happened. The natural world, the flowers, the mountain, the trees, just kind of... that's all I can say. So is this the quality? What is that? Is that pure awareness? Is that... Sorry to... I'm just very curious. Maybe I can just leave it like that.
Well, it's... that's... This whole area is kind of where language runs out. So whatever name you call it, you say, yes, it's pure awareness, or it's the wonderful, or it's the unnameable. It doesn't really matter what you call it. The more important thing is that the way for that quality of sort of freshness and clarity of the heart to be established, that's the important thing. And then the real test is then when you start talking to people and you have to deal with your children and your husband and your work and the rest of the colorful universe, then that becomes really challenging, because when in a situation like this where everyone is silent, of course everyone is silent, right? Just checking. You know, you don't have to be anybody. You're not a mother. You're not a child. You're just a mind, you know? The food is taken care of, the shelter is taken care of, you know, the routine, what you do at any particular time of the day is all taken care of. It's, you just sort of get on the bus and it carries you. So there's no, you don't have to perform as a person in a retreat situation like this. But then when we have to kind of put on the mask and be a person and engage, then that clarity easily gets lost. What's completely obvious, see, is standing on the kind of veranda of your dwelling, looking out over the landscape. Yeah, it's all obviously just this. This is the way it is. This is pure nature, inside, outside. Everything is Dhamma, of course. And then, Mom, I need a new phone. Yeah, and then suddenly, you know, somebody gets born again. Right, so the more that it's not so much the name or how we conceive or conceptualize around that quality of awakened awareness, but how to establish that, to strengthen that, and then to be applying that quality moment by moment through all the different circumstances of our life. When you're not just when you're in a super supportive situation like this, but when the things get more testing, yeah, and more challenging, and so that then decisions need to be made. You know, more testing decisions than, you know, one more banana or not. You know. That might be a big challenge for some people. Should I have another spoon? Yeah. how much ice cream is enough? But in our lives, we have much more challenging questions and issues to deal with than just another mouthful of food. So that's what I would suggest is the priority, is how to really know that quality, to see the pathway for that to be established, and to also to really know the good effects of that when the mind is awake and aware in that way, just to really know the effects of that, the quality of experience when that is, say, actualized. Yes, is there the woman with her hand up there? Yeah.
กับนมัสการพระอาจารย์ค่ะ I would like to ask for your advice about the 5 precepts on not taking one's life. I just wonder that in case that the woman get an abortion because she had been raped by criminal and get pregnant, or you know, like a woman get an abortion to save her own life, are they committing a sin by taking her own children's life?
This is a difficult question. You know, as a monk, yeah, we cannot recommend the taking of life, a human life. You know, if I say, it's understandable, and in that situation, it's not very much bap, and then you go and have an abortion, I'm no longer a monk. Finito. That's because the rules we have around that are extremely strict. So, and that's actually mentioned in the Vinaya Pitaka, that if a monk or nun recommends someone to have an abortion, if they carry it out, then at that moment, as soon as the unborn child dies, then my life as a monk is finished. Parajika hoti asangvaso, you know, you're parajika, defeated. So, but also, these are not easy moral questions. They're challenging moral questions. And so that also as a general principle, as monks and nuns, we don't take decisions for other people. The people can say, you know, can you, often the people will ask me, what should I do? And I'll say, well, I would encourage to people to understand, I can't make your decisions for you. I can give advice, I can give you my perspective, but you make your own choices. So in situations like that, obviously it's a very difficult situation. Someone's been raped, they're pregnant, they had no choice about getting pregnant. But still, the deliberate taking of a human life has inescapable negative consequences, according to the Buddha Dhamma. And so that not only negative consequences for the mother, but also for the child as well. And so that it's the recommendation, as far as giving advice, is that, is that as a monk, you can't encourage someone to have an abortion. You can say, you know, you make your own choices, but there will necessarily be painful consequences that come from that. Whether someone wants to accept those painful consequences is up to them, if you follow what I'm saying. That the intention on the part of the monk or the nun has always to be to respect the life of the unborn child, and to not be dismissing that. But the circumstances that whereby that child has been kind of sort of brought into being, you know, is that say is something that is part of the picture. And say to, and you know, I've been asked these questions a number of times in the past, and so
that I would always say, well, what you choose to do is up to you. But I would say, but there, along with the reasons why you want to do that, or that you feel you need to do that, there will be painful consequences there. So don't pretend that there won't be. Or even if there's a sort of reasons in your mind why it's okay or it's good to do, say, no, there will be painful memories, there will be painful consequences, there will be feelings of regret. And if someone says, well, I can live with that, thank you very much, and they make their own decision, either to have the abortion or whatever. But it's a mistake to say it's, and it's a counter to the Buddha's teaching that, yeah, it's in the situation of a rape or something that was caused or is going to, you know, endanger the life of the mother, that you know, you are doing everything you possibly can to respect the life that is there. You know, doctors have to face these decisions on a regular basis, and there's probably quite a few doctors here that know, you know, that do you save the child or do you save the mother? What choice do you make? And then it's a difficult discussion, either with the mother or with the family, and that is those are tough choices to make. But I think with Buddhist practice, we realize that life continually produces tough choices. It's not, there's not going to be an easy way where that everything is smooth, but rather you are confronted. The mind has to make these choices, and then you make the best choice that you can, and learn from the results of that, so that the choice having been made, either to sort of abort the child to save the mother, or the mother sort of risks her life to give birth to the child, and you know, without knowing whether either of them will survive, then it's the important thing is to be as, you know, supportive as possible for that person in those difficult situations. The what you have with the precepts is, you know, panatipata, is to not deliberately take life, and what you have in Buddhist practice is that this is a principle that you apply, and then you rather than, you know, God will punish you if you break this rule, panatipata viharamani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. This is a training that I choose to follow. So you have that. This is the standard. This is the principle that I respect. Okay, now here's life. So that being the principle, how do we work with this situation so that you do the best that you can by applying that principle? But I feel the Buddha was brilliant in terms of spelling that out. This is a means of training. This is a way of training. It's not like an absolute command, but rather this is a way of training yourself. And then when you do the best you can to follow those principles, but when you don't, then you look at the results of that in terms of the sinha, you know. So for example, not with abortion of a human child, but when I was living at the Paikiri, we had an infestation of cockroaches, and when the little house there got filled with cockroaches, and we had something like 200,000 or 300,000 of them in this one little building. They were everywhere. You know, like you turn on a tap, they'd come out of the water tap. In the microwave, they're inside the clock in the microwave. There were kind of cockroaches everywhere. And so we tried all kinds of things to try and deal with it. And they're very successful creatures. You know, and we're monks, we're trying to follow our rules to not take life, and so we do everything we can, but they're just multiplying, and it's really unhygienic. The place is going to get shut down by the health department. You know, 200,000 or 300,000 cockroaches in a
in a building where you're preparing food every day. So that we actually had to kind of move the kitchen out onto the deck because the kitchen was not safe. You know. So eventually the gamagan, the lay stewards, said, well, look, we've been trying to work with this for months and months. The cockroaches keep multiplying. We've tried everything possible. Can we bring in the exterminators? And we, you know, discussed it and worked hard on it. I said, okay, well, we can do it if we establish. And we learned a lot about cockroaches. You know, it's a whole field of study. So we learned what is the situation that is going to minimize the possibility that the cockroaches would come back, to make it a very unwelcoming environment for them. So we said, okay, we're going to adopt these principles to make it as definitely cockroach-free in the future. And then the people in the committee, they got the exterminators in and killed them all. So there was a deliberate act of killing of, you know, hundreds of thousands of insects, but it was either that or shut the monastery down. You know, so that sometimes we're confronted with these difficult choices, but if you talk it all through, everyone who's involved, and you say, okay, this is, we're aware of this situation. We don't want to do this. There's regrettable consequences, but here we are. And so I feel that, you know, the Buddha establishing this is a way of training. You do the best you can, and then you work with real life as you find it. So the issues about, someone in one of the interviews, there was a discussion about deliberate ending of life, like the choosing to switch off a respirator, or to deliberately terminate somebody's life by saying, I don't want to live any longer. And again, these are situations doctors are in quite often. You know, how much medication to apply to keep someone alive, to let someone die naturally, or to bring about the ending of a life because someone chooses to die. And so this is a big moral question around the world. And say in the United States, in Oregon, they have a sort of they've legalized that sort of choosing to die. In Switzerland, Belgium, they've places that are, you know, clinics where people can go to die or go to be killed. And the doctors are legally allowed to kill people who want to die. And the law supports that. So I feel it's a very tricky area. Need to tread very, very carefully. And it's not just a sort of attachment to a standard out of kind of blind belief. But I feel the Buddha was really, you know, very, very clear about, you know, the deliberate taking of a life has intrinsic negative consequences. So that it has to be acknowledged and really not sort of pushed aside, but to really take that to heart. And then we taking that to heart and recognizing that, then we make the choices that we do, and we live with the results of the choices that we have made. So it's not easy, but I feel that having that primary respect for life, and also acknowledging the negative consequences of taking life, that has to be borne in mind. And then you weigh it up. And that's where meditation and this kind of yoniso manasikara, wise reflection, can be really helpful. Right? So people say, what should I do, Ajahn? How should I solve this problem? I say, well, clarify what the question is. What's the best thing to do in this situation? Clarify what the question is. You know, sit down, bring your mind to as much calm as possible, and then ask that question. Drop that question into the empty mind and see what arises. And that, and use your own meditation as a way of, say, drawing upon that natural wisdom. And that you find that's a way of making, I find the best way of making decisions. So that's the kind of method I use. It's not a matter of just sort of making a long list of pluses and minuses, pros and cons. You're not thinking your way to a solution, but you're more drawing upon your own panya, the wisdom of your own chitta. So I hope that is useful. Maybe Ajahn Piyasila? Yeah. I'm sure you are asked these kind of questions.
นะคำถามที่ถามก็เป็นคำถามที่ยากมากเป็นสถานการณ์ที่มีอะไรหลายอย่างที่ต้องพิจารณาใช่ไหมเรื่องของการทำแท้งทำลายชีวิตเพราะคติทางพุทธศาสนาก็ว่าชีวิตเริ่มต้นเมื่อมีการปฏิสนธิเพราะฉะนั้นก็ปฏิเสธไม่ได้ว่าการทำแท้งนี่เป็นการทำลายชีวิตไม่ว่าจะด้วยเหตุผลยังไงก็ตามคือในฐานะพระเนี่ยก็อย่างที่ท่านอาจารย์อธิบายไปแล้วว่าพระก็คงไม่สามารถที่จะบอกให้โยมไปทำแท้งได้ไม่ว่าจะด้วยเหตุผลยังไงก็ตามเพราะว่าก็ขัดกับพระวินัยก็ถือว่าถ้าโยมทำก็เป็นปาราชิกขาดจากความเป็นพระแต่ก็ไม่ได้หมายความว่าเราไม่เห็นใจหรือว่าไม่เข้าใจสถานการณ์ในความยุ่งยากที่ญาติโยมอาจจะต้องประสบนั้นสิ่งที่พระจะให้ได้ก็คือให้ข้อคิดนะให้วิธีการนะในการพิจารณาบางอย่างเพื่อที่จะโยมจะตัดสินใจเองนะคืออย่างที่บอกว่าในเมื่อเป็นการทำลายชีวิตแล้วก็หลีกเลี่ยงไม่ได้ที่จะได้รับผลนะจากการกระทำนะในชีวิตพระของอาตมาเนี่ยก็ได้มีโอกาสได้ฟังญาติโยมจำนวนมากนะปัญหาเรื่องหนึ่งที่เป็นเรื่องที่หนักมากและเป็นเรื่องที่ค้างคาจิตใจของญาติโยมที่เป็นโยมผู้หญิงนะหลายคนนะก็คือว่าคนที่มีประสบการณ์ของการทำแท้งเนี่ยนะเป็นเรื่องที่ค้างคาใจแล้วก็อยู่ในใจยาวนานมากนะหลายคนเก็บเรื่องที่ตัวเองทำแท้งนะไว้ในใจแล้วก็เป็นสิ่งที่ทำร้ายจิตใจตัวเองยาวนาน10 20ปี30ปีนะไม่หายนะอันนึงก็อาจจะเป็นเพราะว่าความข้ออาตมาว่าในสังคมไทยเนี่ยบางทีมันก็หนักเกินไปเหมือนกันว่าพอไประบุไปเลยว่าการทำแท้งเป็นบาปเนี่ยมันกลายเป็นตราความผิดอยู่ในใจของผู้หญิงจำนวนมากนะคืออาตมาก็มีความเห็นใจว่าคือถ้าสถานการณ์เป็นไปตามปกตินะทุกอย่างมันไปด้วยความราบรื่นชีวิตคู่ไม่มีปัญหาอะไรเลยแล้วไม่มีปัญหาที่หนักรุนแรงอย่างที่คำถามเมื่อกี้นี่คือถูกข่มขืนหรือว่าคุณแม่มีโรคภัยบางอย่างมีอาการบางอย่างที่จะเป็นอันตรายต่อชีวิตทั้งกับตัวคุณแม่เองหรือว่าตัวเด็กที่อยู่ในครรภ์แต่ชีวิตบางทีมันก็มีปัญหาอะไรซับซ้อนกว่านั้นนะสิ่งหนึ่งที่มามักจะถามกลับคือว่าถ้าทุกอย่างมันราบรื่นทุกอย่างมันเป็นไปได้ดีจะมีผู้หญิงคนไหนคิดจะทำแท้งไหมก็คงไม่ใช่ไหมนะการตัดสินใจส่วนใหญ่ก็จะพยายามจากการคิดว่ามันเป็นทางออกที่ดีที่สุดในขณะนั้นใช่ไหมแต่การที่ตัดสินใจตอนนั้นก็ส่วนใหญ่ก็นะไม่เคยได้ศึกษาธรรมะไม่เคยได้เรียนรู้เรื่องจิตใจของตัวเองอย่างละเอียดก็ตัดสินใจว่านี่คือจะดีที่สุดเท่าที่จะเป็นได้ในสถานการณ์อย่างนั้นนะวันแง่หนึ่งเมื่อมันเกิดขึ้นไปแล้วอาตมาก็จะนะแนะนำหรือสอนให้อภัยตัวเองให้รู้จักเมตตาตัวเองนะยอมรับนะกับสิ่งที่มันเกิดขึ้นนะซึ่งที่จริงก็นะก็เป็นไปในทางเดียวกับที่ท่านอาจารย์อธิบายว่าการรักษาศีลเนี่ยนะโดยเฉพาะอย่างที่ยกมาตัวอย่างนี่คือหนึ่งในศีล5ใช่ไหมการทำลายชีวิตเนี่ยจะต้องมีปัญญาเป็นเครื่องกำกับมันไม่ใช่ว่าศีลจะเป็นคำสั่งที่ตายตัวว่าทำในสังคมไทยเราบางทีเป็นอย่างนี้นะคือว่าพอผิดศีล5ก็บาปอย่างเงี้ยผิดเลยนะพอก็เลยเป็นลักษณะว่าไหนๆมันก็ผิดไปแล้วงั้นก็ผิดไปเลยละกันไม่ต้องรักษาแล้วอย่างเงี้ยนะแต่ไม่ได้เห็นว่าศีลนี่เป็นเครื่องมือในการพัฒนานะจิตใจเป็นกรอบของการดำเนินชีวิตนะที่ทำให้เรามีความระมัดระวังการกระทำทางกายทางใจของเรานะให้ดีที่สุดเพื่อเอื้อให้เกิดการพัฒนาสมาธิพัฒนาปัญญามากขึ้นนะตัวอย่างที่เห็นชัดเจนคือถ้าสมมุติว่ามีใครไปทำอะไรที่รุนแรงผิดศีลรุนแรงเช่น ฆ่าคนมาเนี่ยมานั่งอยู่ในรีทรีต10วันก็ไม่มีทางสงบนะมันเป็นไปไม่ได้จริงแม้กระทั่งอย่างที่ทำแท้งต่อให้ด้วยมีเหตุผลที่ชัดเจนยังไงก็ตามเนี่ยความรู้สึกมันค้างอยู่ในใจเนี่ยการนั่งสมาธิบางทีก็ไม่ได้สงบง่ายๆนะนะกว่าที่จะปล่อยกว่าที่จะยอมอภัยตัวเองได้นี่ก็เป็นเรื่องที่นะใช้เวลายาวนานมากนะอาตมาก็มีความเห็นใจนะเพราะฉะนั้นถ้ามันเกิดว่าเราจะต้องอยู่ในสถานการณ์ที่จะต้องเลือกอย่างนี้นะก็ต้องพยายามที่จะชั่งว่าที่ดีที่สุดที่เราจะทำได้คืออะไรโดยที่อย่างที่ท่านอาจารย์บอกก็คือว่าเราก็ไม่ปฏิเสธว่าเราก็ต้องได้รับผลจากการกระทำของเรานะแต่ว่าเราพิจารณาด้วยสติด้วยปัญญาของเราว่าอันเนี้ยมันคือดีที่สุดเท่าที่จะทำได้แล้วในขณะนี้ท่านอาจารย์ยกตัวอย่างเรื่องแมลงสาบที่วัดนะหลวงพ่อสุเมโธก็เคยเล่าเรื่องมดในวัดหนองประพงเหมือนกันสมัยนั้นหลวงพ่อบอกว่าที่วัดเนี่ยมีมดปกติมันจะมีมดดำกับมดแดงนะอยู่ในวัดหนองประพงแล้วโดยธรรมชาติเนี่ยมดดำกับมดแดงเขาก็จะควบคุมกันเองนะก็อยู่ในระดับที่พอรับได้นะอันหนึ่งที่พระส่วนใหญ่จะรับได้ยากคือมดลิ้นนะที่เจอต่อยทีเนี่ยแบบว่าบางคนที่ไม่เคยเนี่ยจนลิ้นต่อยนี่คือสะดุ้งแล้วก็ล้มเลยนะแต่มันก็ไม่ได้อันตรายอะไรแต่มันเจ็บนะหลวงพ่อสุเมโธเล่าว่ามีอยู่ปีหนึ่งนะที่มดดำมีประชากรมากกว่ามดแดงเพราะฉะนั้นสมัยนั้นก็กุฏิอะไรทั้งหลายมันก็ไม่ค่อยสะดวกเท่าไหร่ไม่มีระบบที่จะกันมดได้ดีอย่างทุกวันนี้เพราะฉะนั้นหลวงพ่อบอกว่าที่ไหนก็เต็มไปด้วยมดทั้งหมดเลยเดินจงกรมก็แทบจะเดินไม่ได้เพราะว่าเดินไปก็มีแต่มดนะนั่งสมาธิอยู่บนกุฏิเนี่ยก็เวลาร้อนๆนี่เหงื่อออกมานี่ก็มดขึ้นมาไต่กัดเต็มหมดเลยนั่นก็ไม่รู้จะทำยังไงนะวันหนึ่งหลวงพ่อก็เห็นว่ามีทหารกลุ่มหนึ่งเนี่ยก็ถือถังพ่นยาเนี่ยมาไล่พ่นทั่วบริเวณวัดเลยหลวงพ่อก็เดือดร้อนมากแล้วก็ไปหาหลวงพ่อชาไปกราบเรียนหลวงพ่อชาว่าเนี่ยทำไมเขามาทำอย่างนี้ก็หลวงพ่อก็บอกว่าหลวงพ่อชาบอกว่าถ้าท่านไม่อยากให้เขาทำก็ไปบอกเขาว่าไม่ต้องฉีดที่กุฏิท่านก็แล้วกันหลวงพ่อสุเมโธบอกว่าท่านก็ไม่ทำคือมันก็ชีวิตของเราในสถานการณ์อย่างที่บอกแล้วจะทำยังไงนะแล้วจะหรือว่าเราจะต้องไม่ต้องพระก็ไม่ต้องภาวนาหรือยังไงหรือว่ามันก็มีมดอย่างนี้นะในทางอีสานเนี่ยมันจะมีวิธีคิดอันนึงที่จะมาว่ามันก็เกื้อกูลกับการดำรงชีวิตพระก็คือญาติโยมจะเมตตาพระว่าในเมื่อครูบาอาจารย์ทำอันนี้ไม่ได้ก็โยมก็จะช่วยแทนอย่างเงี้ยโยมก็จะอาสารับแทนนะถึงแม้ว่ามันจะเป็นการกระทำที่มันอาจจะขัดกับศีลก็ตามแต่ว่านะเพื่อเอื้ออำนวยให้อย่างเงี้ยให้ครูบาอาจารย์ได้ปฏิบัติต่อไปก็ยอมสละอย่างเงี้ยมันการกระทำอย่างนี้มันก็เลยทำให้การรักษาศีลนะก็เป็นไปเพื่อการศึกษาแล้วก็จริงๆมันก็ไม่เป็นอกุศลซะทีเดียวหรืออย่างตัวใหญ่อันนึงที่อาตมาเล่าบ่อยก็คือว่าทางอีสานเนี่ยเขาจะมีธรรมเนียมว่าเมื่อสมัยก่อนเนี่ยมันไม่มีตลาดใช่ไหมนะการรักษาศีลข้อปาณาติบาตสำหรับญาติโยมที่เป็นชาวบ้านเมื่อก่อนนี่เป็นเรื่องที่ยากมากนะคือถ้าเราจะใช้ชีวิตโดยที่ไม่ฆ่าสัตว์เลยเนี่ยนะยากมากคือไม่หาปลาใช่ไหมแล้วไม่ทำอย่างอื่นก็คือไม่มีอาหารนะก็มีโยมคนหนึ่งที่พยายามปรณาตั้งใจที่จะรักษาศีล5ตลอดชีวิตเนี่ยก็บางทีต้องกินข้าวกับกล้วยมันไม่มีตลาดไม่มีอะไรเพราะฉะนั้นที่อีสานก็มีธรรมเนียมว่าถ้าในบ้านเนี่ยจะต้องฆ่าไก่นะลูกจะเป็นคนทําลูกจะไม่ยอมให้แม่ทําเพราะว่าถ้าแม่ทําเดี๋ยวแม่จะเป็นบาปลูกจะอาสารับเป็นคนทําให้เองนะอาตมารู้สึกว่าอันนี้เป็นวิธีการที่ยับยลมากเพราะว่าในเมื่อเป็นสิ่งที่จะต้องทำแล้วเนี่ยเขาก็พยายามทำมันให้ดีที่สุดนะคือเมื่อลูกเป็นคนทำถามว่าผิดไหมก็ผิดแน่นอนเป็นปาณาติบาตนะแต่การกระทำของเขาเนี่ยไม่ได้เป็นไปเพื่ออกุศลล้วนๆไง นะก็มีกุศลเจือเข้าไปด้วยว่าเราทำเพื่อให้แม่ด้วยนะอันนี้ก็ส่งผลต่อจิตใจนะศีลทั้งหลายนี้ส่งผลต่อจิตใจอย่างที่อาตมาละพูดให้ฟังว่าถ้าเราทำผิดศีลแล้วมานั่งสมาธิเนี่ยจิตใจเราก็ว้าวุ่นไม่สงบนะศีลเนี่ยมีความหมายนะใกล้เคียงกับคำว่าศีลาที่แปลว่าความหนักแน่นนะของจิตใจนะเวลาที่เราไม่มีความผิดทางด้านกายวาจาไม่มีอะไรที่เราจะตำหนิตัวเองได้การนั่งสมาธิของเรามันก็จะราบรื่นนะแต่ถ้าเรามีความผิดพลาดที่เรารู้สึกแย่กับตัวเองเนี่ยมันจะมารบกวนในจิตใจของเราใจของเราก็จะสงบได้ยากนะแต่ถ้าเมื่อเราต้องมีใช้ชีวิตตามปกติของปุถุชนที่มันอยู่ในสถานการณ์ที่บางครั้งก็มีทางเลือกที่ยากซึ่งท่านอาจารย์ก็บอกว่ามันไม่เคยมีที่ชีวิตไหนที่มันจะไม่มีทางเลือกที่มันยากเลยนะมันก็ต้องมีtough decision ที่เราจะต้องทำเนี่ยมันมีตลอดเวลาอยู่แล้วนะแต่ถ้าสมมติว่าเราเป็นลูกที่ต้องทำอย่างนั้นแล้วนะก็นึกถึงการกระทำของตัวเองมันก็ไม่ลบซะเกินไปนะอย่างคนที่จะต้องทำแท้งอย่างที่โยมยกตัวอย่างอันนี้ถ้าเราคิดพิจารณาอย่างถ่องแท้แล้วเราตัดสินใจว่าอันนี้คือดีที่สุดเพราะว่าทางอื่นนั้นมันส่งผลนะที่ไม่ดีจริงๆการที่เรามีเหตุผลกับตัวเองเราก็ได้รับผลเหมือนกันแต่ผลนั้นน่ะมันก็จะนะไม่หนักมากนะไม่หนักเท่ากับการที่ตัดสินใจด้วยการที่ไม่มีการพิจารณาเลยแล้วอาตมาก็เห็นด้วยกับท่านอาจารย์มากว่าเวลาที่เราตัดสินใจเรื่องที่ยากๆอย่างนี้เนี่ยบางทีความคิดอย่างเดียวมันไม่พอนะเมื่อกี้ท่านอาจารย์ก็แนะนำว่าเนี่ยการปฏิบัติสมาธิก็มีผลอย่างนี้มีประโยชน์อย่างนี้คือว่าไม่ใช่นั่งเพื่อสงบใจอย่างเดียวใช่ไหมแต่ว่าเราเวลาเราตัดสินใจว่าเอ๊ะเราจะทำยังไงให้มันดีที่สุดในสถานการณ์อย่างนี้ก็พยายามทำใจให้สงบนะพอจิตใจของเราสงบพอสมควรก็ถามคำถามเนี่ยว่าดีที่สุดในสถานการณ์นี้คืออะไรแล้วด้วยความสงบของจิตใจเนี่ยมันจะมีปัญญาของเราบางอย่างที่จะปรากฏขึ้นแล้วเราจะรู้ว่าอันเนี้ยคือดีที่สุดเท่าที่จะทำได้นะอันนั้นคือข้อยุติของตัวเราเองในการที่จะต้องตัดสินใจแต่มาว่าอันนี้มันก็เห็นชัดว่าในการปฏิบัติธรรมการทำสมาธิภาวนาก็มีส่วนช่วยในเรื่องของการใช้ชีวิตของเรา
In Japan they have a very skillful tradition. There's in the Japanese Buddhism, like in the Five Mahayana, they have Prabodhisattva, many different bodhisattva, and in Japan the bodhisattva called Jizo, the Sanskrit name is Kishtigarbha. Jizo, the English translation would be Earth Store Bodhisattva. So Jizo Bodhisattva is the protector of children, babies. And so in every temple, they have a kind of Jizo graveyard. So women who have lost babies through miscarriage, or who have had children who've died as young infants, or people who've had abortions, they'll make a little shrine. They have like a gravestone for their child. They're called water babies. And so every temple has a little Jizo garden. And so whether the child has been lost through miscarriage or has been aborted or has died, been born dead, like a stillbirth, or has died young, then they're all together in this kind of Jizo garden. And so then a woman who's had an abortion for whatever reason, then there's a place where she can go and she can still relate to that child that she was carrying, that other being who was with her, for whatever reason that the child died, whether it was through the choice of the mother or however it came about, then there's that connection is respected. And I feel that's a very skillful tradition, something very useful. In the West, it's kind of like pushed away, and that often
women, not just who had abortions, but who had miscarried children or stillborn children, you know, that the child is taken away. They never see their baby. And I feel that that's, it doesn't enable the mother or the other members of the family to really grieve and to let go. And that I feel that was a very good tradition that they have in Japan with that, with respect to that. And there's a book in English, there's a Zen teacher called Chozen Beis, who lives in the USA, in Oregon, who's a good friend of ours, and I've co-led retreats with her in the past, and so she is a kind of Jizo Bodhisattva expert. She was a pediatrician, like a doctor for children in her profession. She was like a very high-ranking pediatrician in the USA, as well as being a Zen master. So she's a kind of amazing person, very, very wise being. And so she's specialized in the Jizo Bodhisattva practice, and has there's a book of hers that she wrote about that, and different practices in relationship to these reflections and this aspect of life. So I would recommend, I don't think there's a Thai edition, but you can get the book in English. So her name is Chozen, C-H-O-Z-E-N, Chozen Beis, B-A-Y-S, Chozen Beis. And I highly recommend, she's an extremely wise person and a very good teacher. And so in a way that she can present those principles in ways that are helpful to support people in their lives, and particularly for women who've lost their children, also a sense of dealing with those decisions, like for many people who have had abortions, maybe before they practiced Dhamma, or even in the midst of being a Dhamma practitioner's life, then they've made those decisions, and ways of processing that and dealing with the effects of those decisions. So I think there's skillful means that we can use. There's also, at the other end of the scale, people who have been in the military, people who have been soldiers, who have taken life in warfare. That there's the aspect of dealing with the karma of killing in the war zone. Like one of my first teacher at Wat Ban Nanachat, Ajahn Prabhakaro, he's a layman now, but he was my first Ajahn. He was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, in the Vietnam War, American helicopter pilot. And so, and one of the big, features of his practice is that, you know, in combat, he gave the order. He wasn't a gunner, he was the pilot, but he gave the order to shoot. And so people died on his order, and he knows that. And so then, living with that memory and the knowledge of that choice has been a driving force of his Dhamma practice. So that there's different teachers who speak about that, for people in the military, also those who have been in prison, just not in a military situation, but who have committed murder or have taken life for one reason or another, then who have become Dhamma practitioners. There's a lot of reflections on people who are in prison for that. One of people that comes to mind is a Thai man called Jay Siripong, who Ajahn Pasanno was giving advice to before he was executed on death row in San Quentin in California. That he was a young Thai man. He got caught up in a robbery. He was involved in a robbery, and two people were killed in that robbery, and then he was arrested and was in prison, in San Quentin prison. And then Dompo Pasanno was invited to give him advice before his execution. And so there's a little book that is about his meeting with Jay Siripong, the advice he gave him, and Jay's own working with his responsibility for having been involved in the loss of the lives of those people who were killed in that robbery, and how he dealt with that, and how he managed to take that really painful, difficult situation and then turn it around so that it was both respecting the lives of the people who had died, but also using the painfulness of that situation for him to wake up. So that, and there's hundreds of thousands of copies of that little book. I think it's called To the Last Breath, The Last Breath. And so that is also the conversation between Lumpo Pasanno and Jay Siripong, and Jay's own reflections are very helpful to get the mind around that whole area, because these areas, they're not sort of black and white. There's not an easy kind of this is right, that's wrong, this is good, that's evil. The Buddha understood that the human life is very complicated, and we face very, very difficult decisions on meeting the consequences of our actions. But even someone like Angulimala, the Buddha was able to guide, who had been responsible for killing hundreds of people. The Buddha was able to guide him to both acknowledge the destructive nature of his life and to accept that, but also enabled him to actually reach arahantship, to be a pra-arahant. So that those are all useful areas to reflect on and to consider and to bring into your practice.
I wonder if you could elaborate more on when you say that you have to really grieve and then let go. So how it's related to?
This is a big issue in the West, is that people, somebody close to you dies, and you're expected to just sort of say, well, they've gone now, just get on with your life, get over it. But I feel there's a natural process whereby there's someone who's been close to you, whether it's a partner or a child, that then it takes time to really acknowledge that loss and that change in your life. And so in the West, there's a kind of, there's a major denial of death. Like, we don't even have funerals now. You have a celebration of life. It's not uncommon to have a funeral with no corpse there, no body, no coffin. It's too depressing. So the family and friends gather together to have a celebration of that person's life, so it becomes a party. And so that feeling, which you think, well, okay, it's nice to have a party, but then all of those feelings of sadness and loss are just buried and kind of denied. And so they're like a splinter that you have, like that's stuck in your flesh, that creates infection and won't go away. So I feel that it's important to grieve. If you know the word grieving, like that sense of salokjai, sadness, maybe not salok, how would you say it? Salso. So that it's a natural sadness. It's not a kilesa. And so in the old days, when somebody died, like if a woman died, her husband would wear black. And that for a year after the wife died, everyone in the village would relate to that person in a different way. He's a widower. You give them some extra space. Similarly, if the husband died, the woman, she'd wear black. And it's okay, that they've lost their loved one. So that they're in a different space, they're in a different kind of category in the village life, because they're dealing with that. And I think in Thailand, the way you have a ceremony like 1 week after the funeral, and then 50 days after the funeral, 100 days after the funeral, and then a year after, it's a way of slowly getting used to that change in your life. And to first of all, when it's a week, everyone's still going, tears and sadness, and then 100 days. Yeah, it's sad, but okay, they're gone now, and the kind of, you remember them and you feel sad, but you're kind of getting on with your life. And then after a year, it's like, oh, okay, yes, well, yes, it's that it's good to remember how they were a positive force in our life, but they're gone now, and so let's remember them in a good way. So those traditions are very useful, powerful. They're a way of letting that grief be processed. And I feel that we can mistake grief for suffering. That there's a natural sad. You can be sad and can be completely at peace with your sadness. That somebody dies, and there are tears, but there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing out of order. It's not like when there's suffering, when there's kwam tu, ching ching. It's like it shouldn't be this way. It's unfair. Why did this happen? Shouldn't have occurred this way. Who's to blame? Someone's to blame. The doctor's to blame. Is the diet was to blame? If only we hadn't had that drink before the car crash, then that was. It's all that stupid. It's my fault. I shouldn't have encouraged that extra drink. And so, we create this idea of wrongness, or it shouldn't be this way, or it's unfair. Even especially for when people die young. But as Lumpur Sumedho would often say, the cause of death is birth, not cancer or the car crash or the infection or or getting drunk. we die because we're born. And so that when there is a natural grief, there's a recognition, yeah, it's sad, but there's nothing wrong. Nothing has gone wrong. Nature has not failed to perform. This is how nature works. Even when it's some stupid mistake that we've made, still, that mistake is still part of nature. It's also interesting to me, there's a comment that the Buddha makes in one of the prasut. He's sitting in an assembly, and he says, now that Sariputta and Moggallana have passed away, it's as if this assembly is empty. So the Buddha is speaking about his own sadness. His close companions have passed away. Now, some people would say, well, that's heretical. How dare you say the Buddha was feeling sad? You know, what kind of a monk are you? But it's there in the prasut. I feel that's one of the great, powerful things, that the suttas preserve those kind of comments. The Buddha was sad that his close friends had passed away. He's not kind of asking for sympathy or saying something is wrong, but just it feels like, even though there's hundreds of people here, it feels empty because Sariputta and Moggallana have passed away. To me, that's a very powerful teaching. He was experiencing the sadness of them gone, but he wasn't suffering because of it. It's not, there's no feeling of wrongness, but yeah, all that arises passes away. They've passed away. But he was able to acknowledge, just like about physical pain, say, the only way I can feel comfort is to completely absorb my mind into emptiness. He wasn't complaining about his chronic pain. He's just saying, here it is. It's this way. And so that I feel that's a great strength of the Pali Buddhism, that the teachings of the southern tradition is that these qualities, these very human qualities of the Buddha are preserved. In northern Buddhism, that's all kind of edited out so that it's kind of glossed over a lot more, almost universally and completely. But in the Pali, in the southern Buddhist scriptures, a lot of that is preserved. And I feel that's a powerful and important teaching for us. So that when somebody dies, we shouldn't feel that it's that, oh, I'm a Buddhist, I shouldn't feel sad. I should get my practice together. And that it feel like it's wrong to have those tears. When Lumpur Sumedho's mother died, she'd just seen him off at the airport. He went to visit them in San Diego, his mother and father. She went to the airport with his sister to wave goodbye. Then she went into the hospital that evening just because she had a bit of a temperature, and she died the next morning. So we got the phone call from his sister at Amaravati and saying, You need to tell Lumpur, his mother just died. It was no warning, just like she went out, like a light being switched off. Just one night in the hospital, wasn't particularly seriously ill, but she woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, the nurse gave her a cup of tea, she took one sip of the tea, put the cup down and died. Just gone. So we had to tell him, and he was on his way to teach a 10-day retreat. So we contacted him in San Francisco, And he told the story himself, how, you know, so suddenly he heard the news, his mother had died, and then he was being driven up from San Francisco to the retreat in Santa Rosa, about an hour and a half. He said, I cried the whole way. He said it was difficult for the driver because I was holding his hand. He had to drive one-handed. He said, but Lumpur, he would quite happily talk about that. Yeah, I was crying the whole way, and I wanted to hold somebody's hand. So my driver did a good job. We didn't crash. But the driver is a doctor himself. But yeah, it's kind of tricky. But, you know, Ajahn Sumedho wanted to hold my hand, so I wasn't going to say, you know, let go of me. But I feel, again, that's here's the great master, you know, this great enlightened Dharma teacher, and yet his mother dies, and there's this sadness. And in that first, there's a wave of grief, and it's quite okay to honor that, to respect that. And then all the Dhamma talks on the retreat were about his mother and what he was experiencing. He had to go to her funeral halfway through the retreat, to fly down to San Diego, do her funeral, and come back. So that was being processed as he was teaching. And so that rather than, oh, well, I've got to lead this 10-day retreat, I better forget about my mother, park her, just kind of, you know, talk about the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, it's like, as a theory, like, no. It's a Dhamma teaching, a Dhamma desana, a demonstration of Dhamma. And what was there was, you know, my mother just died. And the sadness that came with that, but also the naturalness of that, and that the lack of wrongness. You know, she was in her mid-80s, you know, she lived a long life. She had a heart disease for years and years, so she'd been on the edge for a long time. And her husband, his dad, had passed away about 6 months before, so her time came and she just went. So I feel that that sense of just letting those waves of grief pass through, and then also when they stop, not feeling like, oh, I should be crying, my mother's died, and why don't I should feel sad, but I feel okay. That's terrible. I shouldn't feel okay. You know? So sometimes it's like that, that we feel guilty that we're not miserable. Right? And I found with my own mother's death that it was while she was, when I first heard, because I always, you know, her father was 95 when he died, and her mother was 92. So we all thought our mother were gone, you know, for a long, long time. And she was only 83. So it was that, oh my goodness, mum too. And in those first few days, when she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, we knew there was kind of very little that could be done at her age. So it was that I felt the grief when I got the news, and in those first few days. And then when she actually died, I didn't feel sad, because I kind of been with her and let go of her life while she was still alive. And so I had that feeling. When she died, she passed away, and I spent the whole night in the, she died at 8 in the evening, and I spent the whole night in her room with her body. And I kept feeling, I should be crying. why don't I feel sad? Like, well, because it's all right. And so that thought passed through my mind, like, your mother just died. How come you're feeling okay? Like, well, I did my grieving 3 or 4 months ago when the diagnosis came and it was clear it was unstoppable. So that's when the grieving happened. But now she's gone. It's just, well, it's the end of an out-breath. Here it is. So it's also part of that grieving process is when the grief has stopped, no need to feel guilty that the grief has stopped. It's not being disrespectful to not be miserable. But okay, it's run its course and now that's finished. So I think it's definitely time to finish now. So call that to a close for today.